Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Everybody, it's Andy Richter. You're listening to the three questions, and today I'm going to pose those three questions to Mr. Patton Oswalt, somebody who I have known and loved and enjoyed for many years. Too many, really. It's getting tired. Yeah, we need to inject some new life into the relationship.
Or take a decade off and make it exciting again. Let's just not know each other. And then when we see each other again, oh my God, we'll run at each other at a million miles an hour when we see each other.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And then we'll explode into a million glitter bombs.
Glitter bombs.
How are you? How are you?
I'm good. You know, I'm trying to, I got COVID last month. I've got over it, but now I'm, and you have it.
And I have it because we were supposed to do this in person. I have never been to the brand new shiny Conan podcast studio.
It's nice. I was just there because I thought I was supposed to come there today. So I drove there. Luckily, I got there early, so I was able to race back home and do this in time. But the studios are delightful.
I've heard. And beautiful. I was so looking forward to it. But then I went and got COVID. I went and got COVID because I'm a joiner. Everyone else is doing it, and so I just decided.
Ugh. You're like, I'm not going to do TikTok. And then boom, there's your account. You're on there.
Yeah, it's how it goes. Mm-hmm. So how was your COVID?
My COVID was frustrating only because, and I think you're going through the same thing. I'm vaxxed and double boosted, so I had to. I was shooting a TV show in Savannah, so I had to isolate in place for 1 week in a hotel room in Savannah, but I really didn't get any symptoms, so it didn't feel like I didn't even get that cool week of fevers and hallucinations, and I could pretend it was Apocalypse Now. I was just sitting there in a hotel room watching Euphoria on my iPad. It's not the same thing.
And then probably exhausting every possible thing on the room service menu, too.
Oh, well, yeah. Well, no, the hotel I was in was most hotels don't even have room service anymore. They just don't have the staff. So it was a lot of creative Instacarting and DoorDashery.
Oh, wow.
I'm trying to stay healthy that way.
Yeah.
And, Yeah, you got to be home. I was in a hotel room trying to order an Asahi bowl in the heat of Savannah in June, and they would basically, you know, just bring me a milkshake, so yeah. I melted, and oh boy.
How are you? You're pretty busy all the time, man. I mean, you're soaking up all the work, frankly. That's what I want to talk to you. Leave a little for the rest of us.
Yeah, please, come on, let's do something. I like doing stuff. I like creating stuff, so if someone wants to hire me, I'm in. I'm not one of these... Oh, I don't know if this, I just work. Oh, everything that I do will be sorted out after I'm gone. So for now, I just like to work and things.
Yeah, are you, do you still push to do like, you know, like a show centered around you? I mean, I know you did AP Bio. AP Bio. Is that still going on or is that?
No, we got, miraculously, NBC and Peacock gave us 4 seasons for a show that, again, critically acclaimed and no one watched.
Yeah,
but
I've
the
been
fact
in
that
some
they stuck
those.
With it. Well, you are in one of the great all-time one-season shows. Andy Barker, PI, is
thank you.
One of the funniest. It was a, you know, I feel like if Twitter and the internet thing that we have now was more solid, that show would still be on the air, because every episode was just line after funny line after funny line, and
oh,
it just never found its audience.
I really loved that show. That was my favorite of the you know, swings that I took. And the cast was just so solid. I mean, you know,
oh my God,
to get to have Tony Hale on a show and, you know, and Harv Presnell, it was fantastic. You know,
Harv Presnell, the dad, the father-in-law from Fargo, was this great, he was like a pre Alec Baldwin in 30 Rock, where he played everything completely straight.
Yeah.
Everything he said was so funny and so inappropriate. It just killed me. Every single thing he said killed me on that show.
He was, you know, he was a big musical theater guy. Like, there was,
I know,
like, he sang They Call the Wind Mariah. Like, that's, that was his song in a movie. And, you know,
Yeah. If you watch like TCM, when they're showing the big studio musicals from the 40s, there's Harv.
Yeah,
there he is.
Harv, yeah.
Singing away.
He was really great. He was, he's from the Foster's Farm Chicken Ranch family. Like,
wait a minute.
Yeah.
Wait, the one up on I-5 when you're driving north on 5? And
I think
what?
So, yeah. Like, it's a big family business, and he had, you know, and he would that was like part of, when he wasn't acting, he was like going around making sure the chicken business was doing well.
So. Well, that was a man. They don't make him like that anymore.
Yeah, and he flew himself around. He was a pilot. He would fly himself around.
God.
And he said they wouldn't, you know, that like when he got to a certain age, they wouldn't let him fly solo. I think after a certain age, they don't let you do that. So he would take his, I think it was a dachshund, and the dachshund would be the co-pilot on the official manifest. So
song and dance man, running a chicken empire, pilot. I mean, come on.
Yes, I know. He was pretty amazing.
The dude's friggin' Buckaroo Banzai.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
I know. Well, now, you're from pretty macho stock. I mean, wasn't your dad a Marine?
My dad was a 20-year Marine, but I am from macho stock, but I
know.
Not exhibit macho stock attributes. I think I'm all of my dad's recessive genes in one person.
was your dad like a marine, or, you know, was he like,
no, he was
a bookkeeper. I mean, marine,
he was a test pilot. He flew the F-4 down at El Toro, and was but he was one of those guys who, he did 3 tours in Vietnam. So anyone who's actually been in war and seen, and he was wounded, and, you know, he was very pacifist, peace loving, anti-war.
Oh, really? Yeah.
And anyone who's actually been in war is anti-war.
Yeah.
You know, it's the people that have never been in battle that are like, we've got to go and show our manliness. It's like, actually, yes. the veterans are, the actual war veterans are like, you actually don't. You actually you need to. How about you stay home and raise your goddamn kids.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
You know, go get an ice cream. That's actually nice.
I tried it. I did not like it. So yeah, I would not recommend it.
And looking at you, I can tell you that you're not going to like it either.
I always just, the notion of like having to have lived through a draft, which like I even have had friends. Like I had a friend that had dual Greek-American citizenship, and had to go back to serve in the Greek army, which he said was like summer camp. Like there were like there were like guys with earrings, you know, like, and
they don't
but
care.
Still, I just like the notion of having somebody yell at you and make you do push-ups and shit, like, oh, that just sounds, I would never. And also too, like, I a couple of times played paintball. The first time was for a Conan remote, and that was, you know, you had this thought in your mind, like, how would I do, you watch movies, like, how would I do if I were the fish out of water suddenly in the ship?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I would die. I would die immediately.
I would
be
freeze
shot in
up,
the face.
I would freeze up, and I would hope that whoever came upon me would let me go, hey, I surrender. No, we don't need to do this.
Right.
You know, that's why I think a lot of people, a lot of gun nuts really, they go so berserk when, like in this Uvalde situation where the cops didn't do anything, because that's their biggest fear, because they always talk about, if I was in a situation like that, I must... But they know that in real life, like my dad was in Vietnam, he had a machine gun, he had grenades, he had a flamethrower, and if someone heard a shot, the whole platoon would freeze. They wouldn't go, let's run towards the shooting. Right, they'd freeze for a second.
Right.
And these people are, you know, they have the weapons of war and they freeze up. So there's that weird, you know, wish fulfillment that in real life, they're actually worried that they'd freeze up too, which is why I think when a cop or a security guard doesn't run in, they really skin that person alive.
Yeah.
Because that's their biggest nightmare.
Yeah. Well, and it also does it, like you said, it kind of also lays bare the fact that no, more guns won't help. No. Like any one of those situations, like if there's a mall shooting and everybody in the mall has a gun, oh my God, that just like blood how bath. On the face of that, you can't see like that's a terrible idea. That's just exactly. A terrible idea.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network. So whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Can't you tell my love's a growing? So, well, did you feel pressure growing up as a Marine kid?
No, not really, because, again, my dad was very anti-war. So when he saw me going into entertainment, he's like, good choice. Good. Don't go do what I did. He had a really interesting perspective on, I remember I was really down on George W. Bush because I'm like, he's a draft dodger, you know, but now he's sending kids to Iraq. And my dad's like, okay, time out. The fact that he's a draft dodger, that's a good thing. The fact that he was smart enough to know to stay out of the Vietnam War, that is actually in his plus column. The only minus is that he knew to stay out of the war, but he would also think he'd extend that to go, let's keep these kids out of a war.
Right, you know what I mean? Right.
Yeah, but he goes, calling someone a draft dodger is not an insult. That should be in their plus column. He goes, if I had been smart enough to find a way out of Vietnam, I would have taken it.
Yeah.
I just couldn't figure out how to get out of it.
Was he gung-ho when he went in? I mean, he obviously
he
was a Marine, you know?
Yeah, like, he joined the Marines and then, you know, so he wasn't drafted. He was already in the Marines and was sent over there.
Oh, I see.
And when he initially went over there, I have cassette tapes of, you know, reel-to-reel letters he would record home to his parents. And two things are going on. One, he's lying because he's actually on the front lines, but he's trying to make his mom and dad feel better. I was like, I'm in the rear with the gear. Nothing's going on. You can hear explosions behind him. But he's like, they're testing some artillery. Like, he's just trying to reassure them. But he's also, you know, it's his first year in Vietnam. He's like, I think what we're doing here is a good thing. And it wasn't until later that he was like, what the hell was that? You know?
Yeah.
So you see the, you see the evolution there.
Yeah.
Kind of interesting.
Well, that's pretty cool that he, you know, were there other kids that you grew up with, other military kids who you think that they were sort of receiving the same encouragement or disencouragement?
Not really.
Or was he unique?
He was unique. And I also, when I was in college, my roommate was in ROTC. That was the way he was paying for his college. So, you know, so I would hang out with a lot of the ROTC people. So seeing their perspective where it's like, this was my only way out of my hometown.
Mm-hmm.
But because of that, because I was put in such a box, I hope that they were all very anti-war. None of them were like, yeah, let's get in Iraq and kick ass. Because they're like, wait a minute, I'm already getting up at 5 every morning and breaking my back to do this and then taking a full load of school. I don't want the reward at the end of this to be that to be sent in the desert to kill people.
Right, right.
Because that's not what I want to do. So that was also really interesting. There's a lot of, it depends on the perspective of it. Now, sadly, there are people who join the armed forces that are kind of messed up. And like you saw, the people that were at Abu Ghraib were they got off on the sadism and the cruelty, and that's what they were hoping to do. But I think that those are the exceptions that prove the rule. I hope that's not true. I hope those are the exceptions that prove the rule.
Right. Right. Well, it's sort of your persona as a nerd, you know? And I mean, is that what you were as a kid? Like, were you, you know?
I mean, I was just enthusiastic about things. If there's something I liked, I wanted to know everything about it.
Yeah.
So, I got very much into films. I got very much into literature and music. But I don't really fault, like, sports fans because it's no different than what I do
right.
with my enthusiasm. The fact that they know every single draft pick, every draft prospect, this guy went to this university, he's here, and they're, you know, no different than me going, well, I mean, if they do a spinoff movie, if they should do a Colleen Wing and a Misty Knight movie from Daredevil, because those two, like, there's no difference.
Right, right. You know? Well, and that's the thing, is that, like, it's the sports guys that are making fun of, like, to me, it's always been hilarious that guys that make fun of, say, like, people that go see a Star Wars movie and dress up as their, that do cosplay to go there. Those same guys, they're all macho, will put on little uniforms to go to a bar to watch their game. Like, I'm dressed up like my favorite.
That's my favorite, and I have his shirt on. Yeah. I'm like him.
I want to be like Daddy, you know?
Yeah, and these guys that, like, again, why would you fault anyone for having their enthusiasms? If there are people that are into stamps or watching trains, you have something you like. If that gets you through life, then good.
Yeah.
As long as you're not hurting anyone else, I don't care.
Right, right.
You know, or if you're gonna be like crazy sports, like soccer thugs, just beat each other up. Don't beat up innocent bystanders. Beat up other crazy sports fans and keep it within yourselves. That's fine.
Do you feel you are such an ardent fan of genre stuff, you know, of all different kinds of genre stuff. Do you feel pressure, like, to have to keep up on everything? Like, if there's some Marvel show that you just don't care about?
No, I've long ago kind of stopped the whole, all right, I got to check this shit off. I do follow things enthusiastically because I genuinely like them. But I've passed the phase where I'm like, well, I started this series, I got to finish it. Like, if I start a series and it doesn't go anywhere, I'm just like, yeah, I stopped. I don't care.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so there's Marvel, there's Marvel things I haven't seen. There's Star Wars stuff I haven't seen. You know, I like the stuff that I like, but I'm not a completist. I think completism is outside of enthusiasm, and you end up kind of not living a life after a while.
It becomes like a mania or something, you know?
Yeah, and it replaces life.
Yeah.
Yes. And, yeah, and now you're not enjoying it anymore.
Right, right. And also I feel that way. Like, my big thing with it is always like that kind of gatekeeper feeling of, that somebody's got to be, I'm good. This didn't end the way I wanted. And so I'm mad because they owe it to me. Because I just sort of feel like the things that I love, like something like Better Call Saul. I'm just so happy that Better Call Saul exists.
Me too.
I'm just so happy that, like, hey, it's your thing, man. I'm getting so much from this. And even something as kind of, you know, I mean, Game of Thrones. Game of Thrones is silly. Game of Thrones from the beginning was just like titties and butts and dragons. and it's like, and, you know, and then everybody got into it. Because I started watching it from the beginning, and I felt ashamed. Like, I felt like I was like, I shouldn't even mention this. And then it became so huge. And, like, when it ended, people are angry. And I'm just like, hey, what the fuck, man? They gave you, like, however, 5 seasons of dragons and titties? Like, what do you want?
Yeah. And also, keep in mind, the stuff that doesn't end or rise to your level of what you believe things are, then go make something better. And in fact, a lot of the stuff that Quentin Tarantino has done film-wise was based on movies that he saw that he thought they didn't take it the place I wanted to, so I just went and wrote my own.
Went
and wrote my own scenes, and those became movies. So go, and Star Wars started from George Lucas watching Flash Gordon stuff growing up and going, this is good, but couldn't they have also done this? So then he went and did it.
So
go do a better thing.
I agree. And also just, you know, and don't be, it's just the babiness of it. Like, I want.
Also the weird, like, when you say gatekeeper, I also thought you were talking about, and this is another big problem of it, is the, you're into this now. Like, you know what? I've got other shit I'm doing. The art will always be waiting for you. I didn't hear what all these people that are getting down on people for suddenly getting into Kate Bush because of Stranger Things. Why are you mad that a new generation's discovering her?
Right.
You don't own her.
Yeah.
Let people discover it.
You didn't hear her in the womb. You didn't come out knowing Kate Bush. At some point, Kate Bush was new information to you. So fucking relax. Yeah. One thing I remember after Trump got elected, you said, and it might've been on Twitter, it might've been in an interview. Mm-hmm. You said something about, like, you sort of addressed fandom and said something to the effect of, hey, fandom, maybe we should be paying more attention to the stuff that really matters out in the world. Do you remember saying that?
I can't remember. I mean, I did remember thinking that I was guilty of letting these other realms that I dwell in replace the real world for me and what seemed like a lot of minor silly stuff ended up being really, really crucial. And especially we're seeing that now with the midterms coming up and realizing, oh my God, the office of Third Circuit Court judge is actually kind of crucial because that's how they're going to throw elections. They're like, oh shit, like I didn't see this massive plan because it didn't have lasers and ninja swords and kung fu, so it didn't keep my stupid attention.
I
forgot if I said, I mean, look, a lot of people were just, November 5th, 2016 was a rude awakening for a lot of people, you know? Hey, maybe let's not joke about America will never do. No, America is clearly capable of anything.
Yes.
Let's not discount anything anymore.
Yeah. And, you know, and like sort of our innate goodness is like, I don't know. Maybe it's not so innate anymore. And maybe also, maybe our innate goodness was always pretty fucking tarnished with all kinds of ugly, ugly stuff that it was just convenient for us to sort of go, well, yeah, sure, we're racist and sexist and all that, but we're really a shining city on the hill. Like, that was built by slaves, you know.
In my 20s, I was such a douchebag. I was so confused and I was so competitive and insecure. And also, consequently, in denial about what I was and trying to act like I was one of the good guys. Whereas in reality, I had a lot of problems. And then I went into therapy and really looked at and faced and embraced a lot of the shit that I was so that I could then move. I didn't really become successful and happy until I looked at all of my shittiness and went, oh, okay, that's who you are. Own that and start fixing it. But our country is in that phase right now of, we have always been amazing. We have never done anything wrong and we are not going to talk about it. And the fact that like I believe in the Texas School Board wants to get rid of the word slavery in history books.
Yeah.
That is fucking psychotic.
Yeah.
You know, in Germany, there are museums that show you the fucking Nazi horrors and kids growing up look at that and go, we're capable of this.
Mm-hmm.
But knowing that we're capable of this is what will stop us from doing this shit again.
Yeah. And a lot of those kids are going, my grandpa did that.
Yes. You know?
And so it's like, to me, the thing that strikes me about that kind of attitude is it's just so childish. It's putting your fingers in your ears and going, la, 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 la.
Yeah.
And it also, it just, America, love it or leave it, has always struck me as like saying, my mom, love her or leave her. And it's like, you know your mom. You love your mom, sure. but your mom is not perfect.
Like, no,
I won't let my mom drive my kids in the car. You know what I mean?
No.
So it's like, and that doesn't mean that I don't love my mom, but it does mean my mom can be a very reckless, dangerous individual.
Yes, exactly.
And that is the total picture of her. So to say, you don't like this country. It's like, yeah, sometimes it sure doesn't seem great. You know, January 6th, it sure didn't seem great.
Not good.
You know? Yeah.
So it's scary.
When did you start to find that your own ability to be funny was like, it came out of the basis of like coping mechanisms for all of this kind of stuff? For like, adjusting socially and...
You know, it was weird. My ability to be funny came out of the same enthusiasm that I had for horror, science fiction, comic books. I was a big fan of comedy before I even thought of becoming one. I just loved every aspect of it. And so I wasn't the class clown. I was in a clique of clowns. I was in the clique of nerds who loved every form of comedy, that could recite Monty Python, that could recite, you know, every George Carlin album, SNL, you know, SCTV, all that stuff. It was that enthusiasm, and it was that way of going, the knowing comedy and starting to write my own jokes seems to make life way better and way more fun. Like having that faculty. So I learned very early on. It wasn't from any like, oh my God, I'm being bullied or my life is so horrible, because I was certainly not in the A crowd, but I had friends that I liked. And I wasn't like, God, why won't the footballers let me hang out with him? Like, I didn't want to.
Right.
I didn't hate them, but I'm like, what am I going to talk to them about? And why would I inflict myself on them? I had my group that we all liked the same stuff, so I was happy. I wasn't like going to school like, oh, I'm so alone. Like, no, I was with my other nerd friends. So it came more about, I love this. Now I want to know every single thing about it.
Yeah.
You know?
And when did you start to, because you didn't start out like, say, like college. You didn't start out thinking, I'm going to go be a comedian or an actor.
No.
Yeah.
I mean, it was, I started off, I don't know if you had the same experience, between my freshman and sophomore year of college. In my mind, I was going to be a writer, I think. But I think in freshman, between that summer was like, oh, I'm going to graduate in 3 years. I better figure out what to do with my life. Like, I have no job. I have no vocation. Like, what am I going to do? And that was that summer where I did a lot of different jobs. Like, I tried all these different things. And I mean, I was studying to be a paralegal. I was a wedding DJ on the weekends. I was writing. I was doing writing sports for a local newspaper covering sports.
Oh, wow.
Just doing everything. And then
this all in Virginia, right?
All in Northern Virginia.
Yeah.
And then I started doing open mics because, again, I was still really into comedy, and I was this is in like 88. So in 88, there was comedy on TV all of the time. There were just showcases constantly, and it looked really fun. And the people that I was watching that I really, really liked at the time, people like Bobcat Goldthwait and, Robin Williams, of course, that were on TV, Jake Johansson and stuff. I was like, God, I just love this stuff. And so I went to downtown DC and did an open mic. And it was the one thing that I did where there was no immediate reward. The audience really didn't laugh. Like a couple of comedians were like, gave me the, that was good. Like, but it was the thing that I'm like, I want to keep showing up and doing this because I loved the life. Waiting to go on stage, watching comedians hang out, trade jokes, create together out of thin air after a day of whatever they're doing. And now I'm like, this is the life I want. Before I'm even successful at it, I love this hang. I love these hours. I love this rhythm. This is the life I want.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches, but there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered.
Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.
Can't you tell my love's a-growing?
What is the writing process before that first thing? Like, what do you do? Because I don't know how you feel, but I've sat next to people saying like, friends just pushed me up there and I did, and I always feel like, no, you fucking didn't. You prepared.
Are you kidding? I absolutely prepared. I would write out things, trying to make it sound conversational. Instead of like punchline, didn't have like punchline oriented stuff. I just wanted to talk and try to be funny that way. But early on, I was like, I got to put punchlines in here. So it would be very, I just remember that first year was like, it's like conversation. And then you could feel the gear grinding as I then tried to drop the punchline in and just miserable.
Yeah.
And then, it came from, it's the same thing as someone says, how do I become a writer? Just start writing. But write what? Doesn't matter. Just start writing. Well, I'm not going to write until people that are like, wait, like I'll do. I've met people that want to become stand-ups. And they're like, but how did you get on Netflix? I'm like, well, I've been doing it for 30 years. Yeah. But when I start doing it, how do Netflix people come and see me? I'm like, don't even think about that right now. Whatever you're going to be doing won't happen for another 10 years down the road. And this won't matter. Yeah, and you can see those people that are so, they're like test oriented. They're still in college. And like, what are the things I need to do to get the A? And then it's like, there is no, there. It is all up to you. It is not going to just and those people, I always sense like they're going to be doomed because they're like, I'll do comedy when I am on TV and I'm getting money for it. I'm like, then you're not going to do comedy.
Right, right.
You have to like doing this for nothing.
You're prioritizing sort of, I mean, it's nice to get paid to do this, but the odds of you getting paid to do it are so slim that you need to find the joy in the doing of the thing, which for me was improv. And I used to do improv with guys that would, there was one group I was with that was like a really fucking, murderously talented group of like improv killers that kind of, like a couple of guys were sort of in with the guy that owned the space. There was like these Italian brothers that owned the space in this Italian restaurant.
What city was this in?
This is in Chicago.
Oh.
And after about, I don't know, it had been about 6 months or something, these guys just all of a sudden were like, all right, we're wrapping this. We're killing this group because we said at the beginning, if in 6 months we didn't have agents coming and doing the shows, then it would be over. And I was like, it went around and it was like just such wishy-washy, like guys like, okay, well, if everybody doesn't want to do it. And then it got to me and I was like, I never remember anybody saying if we don't get agents in here in 6 months. I was like, and I said, and what I don't have anything else to do. Like, this is really fun. I really like this. Like, why would we end this?
Yeah, what is this, like a George Eliot novel? Your hand is promised in marriage a year must find work. Like,
what kind of
fairy tale shit is that?
Any terminal illness that I'm worrying about. Like, as far as I know, I'm 22 and I've got some time to fuck around.
Yeah. Go ahead. Sorry.
The whole thing just kind of ended up where everybody's like, okay, all right. Yeah. Let's keep doing it. And the two guys that were, had said, we're going to end it, kind of ended it, we ended up having to go get another venue and it was like none of us were good at getting venues. We were just good at doing improv shows.
Are those two guys in the business? Are they successful?
One of them has passed away, and one of them still acts, and and is moderately successful. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
I think that one thing that I wish someone had taught me early on, and I try to impress this upon if anyone ever asked me for advice, is you are not going to believe the ups and downs in your career. And if you think your career has to be a steady climb upward or you have somehow failed, then you are not going to make it. You're going to have, I cannot tell you the amount of pilots that I've shot that went nowhere, movies I was hired for, TV shows I was hired for that I was then replaced in, you know, huge opportunities that went nowhere or were taken away or things changed that I've seen a lot of other people go, I've been doing stand-up. Then I got a spot on Letterman. Now I auditioned for this sitcom. I didn't get the audition. Fuck it. I quit. It's done. Like, it's over for me. I'm like, no, it's not going to be a steady climb.
Yeah.
You know, and there's also people that like, I had my own show for 2 years and now you don't. It's yeah. up and down. There's no, like, you can't, that expectation of steady growth, I think, ruins more talented people than anything else. Each year has got to outdo the last. It's like, no, it will not happen that way.
Right.
There will be some years where you're just not really doing anything and you're just not, it's not clicking for you. You just have to keep at it because you actually like doing it whether you're successful or not.
Right. And do you think that's why you were able to absorb all that rejection? Because it is true. I mean, it's just, you are rejected. I'd constantly. Say 50 to 1 is probably.
Yeah.
Is probably conservative.
Easily.
Yeah.
I remember there was a time, I'm not going to name names, but it was at a comedy show, a bunch of us during the alt times, and a comedian went on stage and they raged about how I wrote this pilot and I shopped the script around and everyone said they loved it and no one bought it. Like, what the fuck? And you could see all the other comedians in the room with not, you know, thinking it but not saying it, going, then write something else.
Yeah.
Welcome to the club. I could show you a crate full of shit I've written that will never get made, that you write something else, right?
Right.
Their whole thing was, I wrote it. Everyone said it was good, and then they didn't do it. So fuck this business. I'm like, yeah, you don't understand how the business
yeah,
works.
Yeah, right.
You absolutely do not understand how this works.
And also the whole notion of something working or not working, it's like, it's always has some kind of alchemy. There's always some kind of magic because
that you can never predict how it'll go.
No. Because there's absolute
Ever.
Shit that gets huge, you know? There's like really shitty stuff that gets gigantic, and you're like, okay, you know, there's a flavor for everybody. And then there's like really fantastic stuff that, like you said, you know, gets its opportunity to be on the air. It's there in front of people. It's arguable whether or not it's handled well, because that is something that can damn mm-hmm. something, is the lack of, you know, participation by the people that are actually hosting the place see it. But it's like, you never know. You never know. And to think that you do is setting yourself up for disappointment.
I tell you, all through the 90s, the 90s was the golden age of amazing, weird shows being done in black box theaters where HBO execs, Comedy Central execs are in that audience watching it kill, and it fucking goes nowhere.
Yeah.
It fucking goes nowhere. I remember, I think I saw you in a thing, if I'm not mistaken, called Not Without My Nipples. Were you
yes,
in that?
Yes, yes.
Which was a brilliant takedown of like Lifetime TV movies and then just showbiz in general. And mm-hmm. it was just phantasmagorical, genuinely Brit with really funny songs. I'll Be Your Beard. I like when you lick me down there, all that stuff. And it just, nothing happened with it.
Yeah.
But I actually
wasn't in that, but it was all the people that I worked with.
Yeah. So. For some reason, I remember. I know Janine was in it. And
my ex-wife was in it. Yeah. So.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I saw you at one of the things.
And I probably was there. But at the time, I was doing Cabin Boy. At the time that they were doing that, I was doing Cabin Boy. So I had, that was my big entree into the film business, you know?
Yep.
And then after it was over, I was applying for a job at an assistant manager of a movie theater, and terrified that Cabin Boy would show there while I was behind the popcorn counter.
Yeah, you can't if you have to love doing this first, everything else has to be secondary. If you are in this for the, if you're in this for the medallions and the badges and the the certificates of achievement, then you're going to go crazy.
You will go
fucking crazy.
Yeah. Paddy Chayefsky said in that there's that famous, you know, Conversations with Screenwriters book. And he said, you know, that the desire for fame and money is perfectly okay for young people. But, you know, and it's like, if that's going to be your engine when you're young, that's good. But it will, that's going to be your engine throughout the whole trip, you're going to be fucking bummed out, mm-hmm. you know?
And you will go, it's why I think so many stars, and this happens in sports as well, I think they go crazy because they hit some crazy plateau, and then they are determined, I must now rise above this plateau. And it's like, no, there's going to be ups and downs, and they cannot handle that, and it drives them crazy. And that's why it feels like every year one hero, one icon goes crazy because they have been driven by what you just said. Constant growth, constant ascension, rather than the ups and downs, oh my God, it's just like, there have been times when I'm like, I guess I'm done. I feel like there was a couple of years, like 5 years ago, I was in a Broadway play that then folded, and then I sort of got the blame for it, even though it wasn't my fault, but it was, and then I was about to leave New York, but then I got cast in a sitcom with Matthew Broderick, and then we did a whole week of rehearsals, and then I got fired from that. And then I asked, I told the producer, I'm like, hey, you'll please keep this out of the press because I've had a miserable month. And he goes, don't even worry about it. And then I flew back to LA. And when I landed, it was a message on my phone going, Patton, I'm so sorry. And the thing in Variety was like, you know, strike two for Oswald. Like,
oh, my God.
And for a year, it was just like nothing. Wow. And for a year, I was like, fuck all of this. I'm just going to go do the goddamn road. I'm going to be a fucking comedian. It just fuck this, you know? And it was the not. So, you know, yes, obviously I'm prey to that stuff, but people that think the whole world, nobody was against me. I wasn't anyone's target. It's just how fucking shit fell. Mm-hmm. You ultimately don't matter in any of this. And once you embrace that, you can go forever.
Yeah. How do you divorce yourself from the rejection? You know, like, because, you know, there's no product. You're not the product that you're selling is yourself.
Yeah, but you know what? Here's how I divorced myself from the rejection. I remember a great interview. I've always remembered this. And actually two genuine great interviews. One with Charlton Heston, where they were asking him about, you know, you were offered Cool Hand Luke. You were offered Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. Like, do you ever kick yourself or not? Because he turned those down. And he's like, no, the reason those movies worked was because they got Paul Newman. It wouldn't have worked with me. That would have actually hurt my career. If you're rejected for something, it's probably for a good reason. Mm. It's probably, you know, and there was another interview with Will Smith where he famously, the Wachowski brothers pitched him The Matrix and pitched it to him very badly. And he goes, I didn't get it. And I politely turned them down. And I went and did Wild Wild West instead. And he goes, the Saturday after Wild Wild West came out, I remember walking around in malls, like, one of people going, I'm really sorry. We're working on Bad Boys 2 right now. It's going to be okay. Sorry about this. Like, having kind of a funny sense of humor about it. But also he said, and you're welcome, because if I had been in, they wanted me as Neo and Val Kilmer as Morpheus. Mm. And if he and I had done it, I don't think the movie would have been successful and there wouldn't have been the sequels. And that's how it was meant to go.
Yeah, yeah.
So now, I really look at it like, oh, if I missed that thing, it was for a reason.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't imagine Charlton Heston is Cool Hand Luke.
And I think Charlton Heston was even saying, and this was a really amazing thing of self-knowledge.
Self-awareness,
He was like, I know what I look like. He looked like a god. I mean, he didn't look like the kind of guy that Strother Martin could break his spirit. Mm-hmm. You know, he goes, it's not my fault that I look like this. I look like a demigod. It's just how fucking look. I'm meant to play saviors and indestructible, you know, killing machines. I'm not this, you know, kind of not self-confident gunslinger or morally conflicted prisoner. You just don't buy it.
Right, right.
You know? So,
Paul Newman is this charming, pretty little thing because he was a tiny little man.
He was tiny, but you could also see him like, oh, he's actually kind of getting by on some charm and bullshit, which is why he was so lovable, because he had that vulnerability of, oh no, I know I look, I know I'm really handsome, but I'm actually kind of full of shit. And I'm trying my best to keep that covered. And it's kind of great, you know? God, he was such a brilliant actor. God damn, was he good.
Yeah, he was really fantastic.
Yeah. I mean, especially like people forget how good he was at playing characters that are full of shit and are completely overcompensating and really connected with people that are going, oh God, I think I kind of do that half the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wish I was that good looking while I did it. Cause he was also, I remember, years ago, I was going out with this girl and I was really, you know, I love classic movies and she doesn't. And I think she was taking a plane somewhere. She goes, should I watch something on the plane? I'm like, watch HUD. She was like, what? She goes, watch HUD. I think HUD's right now on like, you know, they have those classic movies.
Yeah.
She'd never seen HUD. Yeah. And then she like texted me when she landed. She was like, oh my fucking God. Why didn't anyone tell me that this guy, like she had no idea how redonkulously sexy that dude was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
And playing an evil full of shit character.
Right. Right. Yeah. No, he was like, yeah, it's like, you know, Bill Murray got away with that for years and years.
Yes,
like just playing like, you know, or Ferris Bueller. Like I watched Ferris Bueller with my daughter, you know, a few years ago. And I was like, Ferris Bueller's a fucking psychopath.
I watched it with my daughter too a few years ago. And she's like, he's mean. She hated him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That we just aren't as charmed by that. But
no,
it's like
not anymore.
The lovable, I don't give a fuck white guy. Mm-hmm. It's just like, yeah, it's not so much fun anymore.
Oh, by the way, there's another quote. I got it. I was at a party. This was years ago. Someone's birthday party. This was decades. This was like in the 90s at the Brass Monkey in Koreatown. It was someone's having a party. They're having a karaoke party.
Karaoke
all
party,
the comedians. Yeah. All the comedians are there. Everyone's hanging out. And Carrot Top was there. Everyone knows Carrot Top. His real name is Scott Thompson, nicest guy on the planet.
Mm-hmm.
He's great. And so he's hanging out. And I think I and a couple other people were hanging out with him talking. And these couple of like classic Silver Lake hipsters came up to him. You can tell that they had been like commiserating in the corner. Like, God, dare you go do it. Go do it. Go do it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And they walked in. They're like, hey, so like we're watching that movie. You were in like chairman of the board. He goes, oh, yeah, yeah. He's yeah. Like, why'd you make that piece of shit? Like, and then Carrot Top went, why were you watching it? Like, they paid me to do it. You wasted all, what the hell is wrong with you? And the guy's like, yeah, okay, I mean, yeah, it was okay. And then he just like scattered away. Like, it was, whenever someone goes, why are you in that piece of shit? I'm like, why did you watch it?
Yeah, yeah.
You shouldn't watch
it's my
that.
Job.
It's terrible.
Yeah. It's like nobody says to a plumber, like, why'd you fix that sink? You know?
That thing was full of shit, and you put your arm in it.
Yeah,
what's wrong
I had
with
to.
You?
Right, right. Yeah. That's what I
That's
do.
That's how I get money, you dumb dumb.
Now, you do have, I mean, and you know, not a lot of, when things were rough, you can hit the road. You can
go
out
can
as
go
a
do
comedian.
Stand-up.
And did you find, as you kind of started to get more work as an actor, like, that split, like, did you always want to keep that, you know, your fingers in both of those?
Yes.
Or was there ever a point where you're like, you know, if I can just act, I'm just going to act?
No. I can remember pretty distinctly a couple of comedians who I could tell early on, they are in comedy to get out of comedy. This is a way to get out of it. I do movies and TV shows so that I can increase my profile and do more stand-up. Like my ultimate goal is to keep doing stand up. I'm very fortunate in that, you know, I've been offered things. I've just been in the right place at the right time. I walked off stage at the Largo one time and walked into the kitchen and Paul Thomas Anderson was standing there. He goes, shooting a movie. You want to be in it? I'm like, yeah. And then he goes, I'll call you tomorrow. And then I was in Magnolia because I was like, you know, that kind of thing. So, you know, I like the business. I like doing creative things and I like working with new people. This new movie I have coming up is pretty much a first time director. It's his second film, but I just love when someone goes, I got this project. It's so friggin' weird. I don't know how it's going to work. I'm like, oh, please let me read that. Like, cause I'm a movie buff of that from that time, especially the early 70s where it was like, we're going to go shoot this thing. Don't know if it's going to work. Let's give it a whirl. Like that kind of attitude. I love that kind of movie making. I love that kind of TV, especially now. Right now, television is the way movies were in the early 70s of the heads of networks have openly just gone, I don't know. Try it. Why not?
Yeah.
And it's right, great. It's like this, let's see what happens.
Yeah, that's good. It is good. What is there something, you know, like the juice that you get from like what the and by juice, I mean like the thing that hooks you in. Is there what describe the different juice you get from acting and the different and as opposed to the one you get from stand up? Like which?
Well,
why do the two things
question,
have their hook into you?
Because with acting, you are surprising yourself and surprising another creator by interpreting something that they wrote, and you know that they had a way that it sounded and looked in their mind, and then you are bringing something so totally alien to it, but trying your best to interpret what you think is on the page. But when you see their start, sometimes their delight and surprise at, oh, I didn't see it working that way, but that actually works better. Like, so it is a very much a collaborative process. Or the other kind of juice you get from that is, I'll try it one way and they'll go, try it this other way in a way that you normally wouldn't do it. And you'll find a whole other aspect of yourself that was in the words, that was in you, that you didn't realize it was there, but it's there when you're in action with other people, with your scene mate, with a director, with a writer. Other parts of you will come out of it, which is that every aspect of that is thrilling. You know, like when you're in a, you'll have the scene one way in your head, then you'll get into the scene with someone and they'll give you something that you weren't expecting, and then something totally new comes out of you, and it's amazing, and I love that. So there's that. With stand up, the thrill for me is you create something out of absolutely nothing. There is nothing there but the tiniest idea. I think this might be funny. Maybe there's something to be gotten there, and then you slowly overnight you build it. There's that great sequence in Jerry Seinfeld's documentary Comedian where he has that bit about think tanks and like how do people get fired from a think tank, and he in the documentary he shows himself on stage successive nights just not delivering. He hasn't cracked it And then they show him sitting with Colin Quinn and George Wallace, and George Wallace gives him the nugget that cracks the bit, and then he's got it, but it came out of nothing. So it's almost anti-collaboration in a weird way. You have to crack open a puzzle that is in your head. It's there. You just have to unlock it somehow.
Right, right. And it's like that amazing footage of Paul McCartney writing Get
Back.
Oh,
my God.
In that documentary.
Out of thin fucking air.
Yeah.
Isn't it weird watching that scene? And you're watching going, JoJo, you know, Tucson, Arizona, dude. Like,
Because
you already know the song in your head, and he's not there yet.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
And you see George Harrison and Ringo Starr sitting there looking at him, and they know, like, oh, wow.
Oh, here we go. Something's happening.
Like, yes, you know. There's gold coming out.
That's the same thing with the Seinfeld bit. He's like going, he's sitting at that, he's at the olive tree after doing, and again, the bit has not worked. And he's like,
how sad. Like, that man needs to go to better restaurants.
He really, not the Olive Garden.
Olive Garden.
No.
Okay, never mind.
Olive Tree, you weirdo.
I'm sorry. He's so rich. Why would he go to the Olive Garden?
Well, in his defense, he had purchased the one that he was in.
I love the breadsticks. I love them.
It's bottomless. They're never going away. And he's sitting there. So he's like, people get fired from think tanks. Like, how does that happen? And you could tell, like, he knows there's a bit there. And then George Wallace just, like, tosses off, like, the guy getting fired. He's like, look, Frank, sometimes you don't think. And you see Seinfeld's face. Like, the whole thing just lights up in his head. Like, he suddenly has the entire bit. And it's such a great moment.
Yeah. That's always fun when somebody can give you like a little nudge that way. It's always. Yeah.
And George isn't even going, do the bit this way. He's just like, oh, I'm just riffing out. Like, let's see where this goes. And he unlocks it for him.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Has it been hard? Like, you know, you've been through some really tough times. I mean, you lost your first wife, passed away. Has it been like, is it hard to do comedy in those times, like in rough times in your life? Is it hard to go out and say like, okay, here comes the funny guy going to make everybody be funny?
Yeah, I mean, I know that people have been able to go up during some pretty horrible dark times and be funny because of the darkness. Richard Pryor, very famously, Dana Gould, was amazing at that. Tig very famously went up the night of her cancer diagnosis. I'm not one of those people. It took me a few months after Michelle passed away. And even then, I was just tentatively going on stage and getting no laughs and just getting back into the rhythm of being on stage again, because it was such an alien aspect, you know, and it took me a whole other year to even get, you know, feeling like I belonged, because in my mind I was like, what fucking right do I have? It was a lot of talks with my therapist about that, about, you know, how do I get back up doing this? But it's like, what else am I supposed to do? It's what I do in the world.
Yeah.
It is what I do. And, you know, my late wife was an amazing investigative journalist. If I had passed away, I certainly would never want her going, I will never write another word again. I'm like, no, the thing that I love, I want you to keep existing as the person I loved. I don't want to, it's bad enough that I've been taken out of the world. I don't want to take you out of the world too, you know? So, but it took me a long time to get there.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah, because it was, I mean, it was such, I mean, I was amazed that you could do it. And I mean, the first times that I saw you out in the world doing it, I mean, you were you and you were hilarious. And I just, you know,
it
made it, you know, funny and also very, very poignant to see you doing that, because
it was not easy and it was really scary. And it was really scary up until I went on stage to that special, the one that, and Bobcat Goldthwait directed it. And until I did like the first 5 minutes, and then I was in it, then I'm like, now I'm okay. Now I'm back and I can start to fight my way back. But it took that long. It was rough. It was rough.
Well, where are you going from here? I mean, not from this particular, you know, from
I have to pee, so I will be going to, there's a bathroom down the hall.
All right.
I don't know when this drops. My God, I have, you know, I'm at Just for Laughs this year, hosting one of the galas. That'll be on July 29th. The following week, here's what happens
just
the following
for
week. Just for real.
Yeah.
On Friday, August 5th, my movie, I Love My Dad, premieres in theaters. This is this little
indie. Is that the one you were talking about before?
Yes.
Okay.
We took it to South by Southwest, did really well. Now it's in theaters. On the same day, the series The Sandman, which I'm a character in, debuts on Netflix. So that's coming up. And then at the end of the month, August 24th, my first creator-owned, created from the ground up comic book that I did for Dark Horse comes out.
Oh,
Minor Threat. So that is also coming out. So right now, this is the promo portion, and then next month is everything's dropping. So it's crazy. It's crazy.
That's nice. Yeah. Do you pursue film and television product? Are you developing a lot of things for yourself? Is that something that you do still?
I am definitely. There's a show that, well, we were taking it to HBO Max and now it's back up in the air. I did that show MODOK, you know, a couple of years ago for Hulu and Marvel. There are things that I'm developing, but I'm also right now very fortunate to get to go act in things, to be asked to be in things. So there's a big, huge show for Apple TV that I'm doing. That's me back and forth to Savannah shooting this. And then other stuff that I'm developing for myself, but it's an embryo and I don't want to talk about it yet.
Right, sure.
You know how that is.
Do you like being number one on the call sheet, or would you rather be lower?
Four and five is the sweet spot. I don't want to be number one.
No.
I want to be three or four or five.
Too much pressure.
Perfect. No, man. Don't make me carry this thing.
I know.
Yeah.
It's always
let Brian Cox do that. God.
The thing too about that is that, like, you also too then are like, you know, I'm using jargon here, but like, you're laying all the pipe of the story.
Yeah.
Like, you also, can't you're do not it. Just getting to be the wisecracker that's off to the side, you know, or the murderer or whatever, you know, like, have you ever got to be the murderer?
Any
live action thing?
Live action. Like, I was the murderer on Veronica Mars revival. I was the big murderer in that. I was also the hidden bad guy in both of the Reno 911 movies.
Oh, yeah.
That was really fun. And then also in a little Quibi series, unfortunately, that didn't go past it because Quibi collapsed. But it was called Paula Pell's show. Oh my God! It's like her. Oh, why can't I think of the name? But the Mapleworth murders, which was fucking hilarious.
Yeah, murdering is the best. Getting to murder people.
Have you been a murderer in things?
I got to be a murderer on Monk.
Nice.
I played a murderer on a Monk episode, and it was really, really. I mean, and it's something too that I feel like I could do pretty well. Like I'm always kind of cast as like the slightly dumb guy or like the friend, you know. But it's like I always am kind of like, let me have a crack at Dabney Coleman. Like, let me be a prick because I certainly have it in me. You know, I'd really like to be a prick to somebody.
Yeah.
But it's nice. Yeah. And one thing I love, like when you were talking about doing, things that are just sort of experimental and what the fuck, the Heart She Holler is so, like, you doing that thing is just so, like, I just love that you did that because that was a lot of work. Like, there's a lot of work in that thing. It's not like you just went off for a day.
No, that was intense makeup, special effects, covered in goo. But I love Vernon Chapman and I love Mike Lee. And when they pitched that to me and they go, basically, we want to do a comedic version of Wisconsin Death Trip, which is one of my favorite photo books. Michael Lessie. And I was like, stop, I'm in. I'm in.
Yeah,
I don't care. I'm in. So yeah, one of the best things I've ever done. I love that show.
Yeah. It's great. If you haven't seen it, check it out. It's you won't see anything weirder on television.
No, you will not.
You will not. You will not.
I do need to pee. I think I'm going to have to end this.
All right. Well, can I just, there is the final question, which is like, what have you learned? Like, what do you, you kind of said,
I've learned the more comfortable you are with actually not knowing everything and having to ask questions and learn new stuff from people and not have to win every encounter that you're in, you will have a much more adventurous, much more enriching life.
Yeah.
Rather than go, I've got to be the alpha here all the time.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Patton. Go pee.
I'm going to go pee.
Yeah, go pee. Have a good day. Man, that feeling when you really have to go, it's like, those couple of minutes after that, they should make a pill. I've always said they should make a pill of that feeling.
Yeah, post-pee pill.
All right.
I'm going to stop recording, and I will send you this thing, and we'll be done.
All right. And thank you all of you out there for listening. I'll be back next week with more Three Questions. I've got a big, big love
for you. The Three Questions with Andy Richter is a Team Coco and Earwolf production. It is produced by Lane Gerbig, engineered by Marina Pais, and talent produced by Galitza Hayek. The associate producer is Jen Samples, supervising producer Aaron Blayert, and executive producers Adam Sachs and Jeff Ross at Team Coco, and Colin Anderson and Cody Fisher at Earwolf. Make sure to rate and review The Three Questions with Andy Richter on Apple Podcasts. Can't you tell my love's a growing?
Love the flexibility of working in all sorts of places? Well, working on the go seamlessly requires a strong network like T-Mobile. We have America's largest 5G network, so whether you're on a video call at the park or uploading large files at a coffee shop, we have the 5G speed you need. Whatever takes you on the go, T-Mobile's got you covered. Find out more at T-Mobile.com/network today.
Coverage not available in some areas. See 5G device coverage and access details at T-Mobile.com.